This set is proceeding here, 1982 in one form or another, and it continues. I'd like to remind people, if anyone has any questions and they can't get on the radio and they want to use the mailbag option, they can email me. If they have any topics they would like me to discuss, if they have any puzzles they would like to share, or if they would like me to tap Paul WS2N on the shoulder and ask him his opinion of some YouTube website or news story that's space-related. Email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to a bunch of different things are available. Tonight we're trying something out to see if it works. We keep science talk du jour. I give you a bunch of topics that I've prepared, that I've been preparing all these months, but we never really get to the science talk. So if anyone is interested in any of the topics, we'll leave it open. After the corner, if you want to ask for any of those topics, that's available on the link page. Page being roy.ac2gs.com. Also, I mentioned YouTube, and the link's still available there. It's on Lens and Law, and the gentleman does a really bad job of demonstrating something, but it's worthy of discussion of how you can arrange an experiment incorrectly and get meaningless results. As always, there's the chat room that's available. You can go either through LIMARC.org's website, or you can just type in the entry chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll open the chat room. Anyone who would like to listen to an audio stream of the Technical Net, we provide one. You type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, MikeAC2NJI is always there with the archives of the Technical Net going back to 2006. That's available at amateurradio.tv. Again, amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a second and I will continue.
E2OGB.
Yes, Craig, we haven't really asked for questions yet. We'll get into it in a moment.
Hey, you got some very frequent cutting in and out.
Okay, let me try and finagle the RF power. Give me a sec.
Got a bad antenna, guy.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. That's I'm down to my last antenna. Three of them went down in the storm. So let's try again and tell me if this is understandable at all.
Good now.
Good copy.
Okay, I juiced up the power, so hopefully that will be the end of that. Once again, I want to remind everyone of a couple of things that I mentioned earlier, but just in case. If you need to contact either me or Paul, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links, including suggested topics if you want to ask science talk type of questions later on, is available, as well as a link to the YouTube presentation on Lenz's Law where they get the experimental method a little bit off. That's available on my link page at ac2gs.com. And the chat room is available. You type in chat.ac2gs.com. And the audio stream should be available on internet.ac2gs.com. Again, let me drop again, and I'll go on with the rest of tonight's planned adventure. Okay. We will take questions from the audience and topics and have some discussions and maybe discuss the YouTube that I posted a link to. Around 8:30 to 8:45, we will introduce Andy, WA2CDL, for Andy's Corner, and that will go on, and then we will return again and ask you if anyone has any questions or if anyone wants to pick from the Science Talk du jour list of my link page, and we can discuss the topic on that if time permits. And then around 10:15, we will have Paul WS2N with the space report. I will ask people if they have any questions or topics tonight to give me their first name and their call sign.
Okay, then K2TGW left.
John, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Name on the list tonight for any questions or topics.
John, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Okay, John recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight for any questions or topics? Okay, Les, you're first up. What's your question or topic tonight?
All right, theoretical more than anything else. On the side of the house, I have a 6 feet of dipole. Question, if I could find myself a thin piece of 30 plastic of sun, if I wrap the arm or each leg around that tight curl, therefore diminishing the length, so say by 45%, what would I lose besides the length? Say I wanted to put up on a
Okay, so if I understand the question, you basically want to change just a generic straight piece of wire to a helical coil-like material.
Yeah, something like that, to put around some kind of a plastic or PVC or something like that, just to shorten. So if I say I wanted to have a 6 meter rotatable dipole, I would not need something as long. Not that a 6 meter dipole is long.
Yeah, I mean, there are actual designs that sort of are very similar, the so-called antenna, in which rather than a straight piece of wire or a piece of wire that's zigzag, they just stretch out something that looks a lot like a slinky. You could do that, and certainly you can design it to be resonant at 6 meters. My assumption would be, and I'm looking forward to electrical engineers either giving me a different idea or suggesting aspects, that you're going to get some efficiency loss due to the inductive coupling of the inductor that you made. If that wasn't the case, then if you loaded a shortened antenna with an inductor, the efficiency would hopefully be the efficiency changes would be inconsequential, and yet I'm sure you've heard stories of mobile antennas that have a shortened length that are designed for something semi-ridiculous like 160 meters where most of the loading is going on with an inductor. Those things often have efficiencies of 2-3%. So I don't think there would be that much price to pay as far as loss of efficiency, but I think the general efficiency of the shortened, helically mounted antenna would be a little bit less than a straight piece of wire. But I'd be interested if guys out there have a different opinion. Okay, I think I heard someone try to key up the repeater, but it was 100% noise.
Attention.
Yes, Wesley?
Yeah, I'm thinking. Well, you look at the coil antenna, it's circular polarization antenna versus the dipole antenna. Which would be that two big hits in characteristic. It is something like a coil shortened dipole antenna, and there is a calculator for it. Practically, there is no difference between two. If you take a look at the car antennas, some of us have a huge, big whip antennas, and we know that the counterpoise for it is the body of the car, right? And then you look at new antennas used by the police, which looks like a very short a cylinder that is 1 inch in tall and probably 2 or 3 inches in diameter. And then both of them are antennas. But then you're looking about a whip antenna, which is a dipole antenna with the counterpoise of the body of the car, and the other one is a coiled piece of wire of the same exact antenna in the length, and it doesn't matter how you shorten it. So the shorter, the smaller the antenna, it will perform exactly as a huge, big antenna. The only difference is performance. So the only difference is efficiency. Do you agree with that? And to appreciate.
Yes, Wesley, I agree. That's what I mentioned. I mentioned the difference is going to be the overall efficiency. I mean, Dick, K2RIW, used to talk about the radiation aperture, and for all intents and purposes, those factors are identical, whether it's a shortened radiator or a resonant radiator. But the problem is that these components that electronically resonate the shortened radiator impose a certain amount of insertion and coupling losses, and thereby the efficiency goes down. Now, my understanding of the coil, well, the cylindrical shaped antennas that you're alluding to, I do not think that they are just coiled inductors. I get the suspicion that they're very similar to the compact antenna that we were talking about a few months ago, which is a sheet of metal that's spirally rolled into itself. So that's not quite the same as a helically wound piece of wire.
Okay, with your permission, let me say a few more words about it. So we have an inductor or loading coil, and we think how it works and what it do, what it does. What does the coil do? Normally, physically, physical smoke compared to antenna length of wavelength, loading coil or loading inductor does not replace a missing fraction of the wavelength. A physically small loading coil simply inserts a series of inductive reactants that cancels capacitive antenna reactants, especially we're talking about the mobile antennas, but not only. So don't limit that to that loading job. When a 150-ohm reactance inductor is inserted in series with 150-ohm capacitive load like an antenna, reactance is canceled. Only the resistive part will remain, which is normal. Which that's nothing new. So now we need to think what determines the current distribution in loading coil, just to make sure what the processes are in the coil. The current distribution is determined by stray capacitance, the outside word of the impedance terminating the loading coil. The current in an inductor would be equal, and each end, except for the displacement current, which would be the imaginary current that flow through the capacitance. A changing electric field is tied to those currents. And then the next question would be how much level difference is there in loading coil current entering the coil and loading coil current exceeding the far end. So if the antenna beyond the coil has the low self-impedance compared to the impedance of the stray capacitance that shunt current from the coil to the ground, the current at each end of the coil will essentially be equal. The current taper effect is not caused by the missing antenna length. The coil replaces. The current taper is determined by the ratio of termination impedance to stray capacitance from parts of the coil surroundings. So if the portion of an antenna above or beyond the loading coil is long or has a large physical area compared to the physical size of the coil, coil current will be essentially equal through the coil, and at each size of the coil, coil current will be essentially equal throughout the coil. Let me put it this way. In the tank circuit, inductor current is equal at each end unless the tank capacitor have a very low value compared to the tank inductor stray capacitance to the chassis. This is the only one reason why we do not want to mount an inductor close to the sheet metal. To wrap it up, the difference between the loading coil and normal inductor would require for me to add a few more things, but I don't want the audience to be bored with explanation of reduced system bandwidth and reduced effective Q. But the truth is that both of the antennas, your huge big quarter wave dipole and the small antenna that is a coil mounted on your car, they work exactly, absolutely exactly the same. The polarization is different because you mostly in a coil you have circular polarization, but the effectiveness of that antenna is differently understood based on the frequency it operates. Usually, with the dipole antennas, we have a very nice bandwidth from the main fixed frequency on that particular band. And if we move a little bit left, a little bit right, we have about 70% of that what we have at that very much resonance point. The different story is with the coil antennas, which are usually very narrow or extremely narrow. That's why most of those antennas used by commercial services like police, they are fixed frequency, working only on that frequency of the application. And sometimes we may observe that at certain bands, even though that the coil antenna is made for the ham radio amateur, it has the motor into it just to tune the slider on the coil to give it a proper position in within the given band. So if we have 14 megahertz of band, and we have a coil that is a 5-band or 4-band coil, not only the slider has to electronically be driven, so the motor stops at a middle of that particular band, but that band is that resonance frequency on that particular band is probably 1/20th of what it can cover on that particular band. So if you take the band, you divide it by 20, and then you take that portion, and that portion will have a one maximum resonance frequency for that particular coil. Then you see how much you can move left and right in order for you to maintain 70% of the resonance on that particular antenna. If you want to move to just a neighboring part of the same band, you have to then move that slider on that particular coil, and again, your bandwidth will be probably the same. So that's the inconvenience if you don't have a motor on the antenna that you have if we operate with the coiled antenna. That's actually it.
AC2GS.
Yeah, I understand all that, Wes. I mean, basically what you're saying is that if you mechanically shorten an antenna where it's no longer mechanically resonant and then you electronically resonate it with an inductor, you increase the Q of the radiator, which means that the bandwidth of resonance is narrower, and you have to correct the inductance for a different frequency. That's all well and good. I think we're kind of going off into a tangent. Les's question was he wanted to put a little bit of a helical modification to a dipole, and he wanted to know, if it paid any particular price. I think it's important to know kind of how much of a helical twist you put on it. If it's a very light helical twist, I think the efficiency costs are very small. I think the increased Q is very small. You will get a slight difference, in my opinion, of the polarization angle of the radiated RF. Antennas, we talk about their linearly polarized, but really antennas are elliptically polarized. In the extreme case on one end, it looks linear. The extreme case on the other, that's perfectly circular. So I don't think that this is going to be a perfectly circularly polarized radiator. It'll just be a little bit more elliptical than linear. But otherwise, I think there's a slight little minimal efficiency price to pay, but otherwise, it sounds like a nice experiment to try out.
Two more words.
Yes, Les.
I figured I would lose something, but if I'm going to be able to rotate it, gain back any efficiency I would lose by being more directional. Of course, in both directions, but I would be able to get more directional and power out. Trading one for the other might be worth shrinking it a little. I'm not taking the full size out, just definite length, straight out.
I'll let me hear something.
Okay, one second, Wesley. I just want to respond to Les. I think that's a good reason why, by shortening it a little bit, you make it more mobile. So now you have the additional modification of rotating it in space to benefit the approximately 2.15 decibel gain from an isotropic radiator. So, again, I think it's a very interesting experiment, and I think that you're not going to pay much of any kind of a price personally, but it'll be interesting to know. Wesley, you wanted to add something.
How about if I claim for the moment you're not losing efficiency, but you're losing efficiency? How should we understand that? But you're not losing efficiency in within that bandwidth, reduce system bandwidth, or reduce antenna bandwidth with one main frequency. So that has to do with stray capacitance, where we have turn-to-turn capacitance that increases effective inductance and effective resistance, yet at the same time, unnecessary straight capacitor reduces the synthetic system bandwidth, and the contradictory reduces the effective Q of an antenna. But what I try to say, and I would like to have your opinion, Roy, let me drop it. If he tried to reduce the size of the antenna by adding a helical coil or any kind of shortening the antenna, and you take that one main frequency, so let's say there was 14 megahertz, and now and we had a half of that one bandwidth that was the main resonance frequency, and now we have the shortened antenna with reduced bandwidth, where one-tenth or one-twentieth of that band now should be seen as having the main frequency, and then we have a little left and a little right to move. at the very much resonant frequency, we're not losing any efficiency. Right, Rook?
I would tend to disagree with that. My understanding is that even if you tune it to the specific resonant frequency, by adding imperfect electronic impedance adjusting circuits, the laws of thermodynamics, they introduce some degree of loss. So I would tend to disagree with that.
By what means you understand imperfect?
All these components have complex coupling interactions. They have inductive coupling, they have capacitive coupling, they have a small amount of insertion loss. So it's never zero. It's never a perfect component. The imperfections cause coupling and insertion losses, and the efficiency just inherently goes down. May not go down a great deal. You know, if you have Jet Propulsion Lab design your impedance matching a network, then probably you could squeeze out 99.9% efficiency, and the design will only cost $3-4 million and require a lot of cryogenically generators and such. But I think, unfortunately, you always pay for doing things. Physics doesn't let you get away with stuff. So it might not be a significant loss, but I think it's inherent to any design of any real-world inductor or capacitor that it will introduce a non-zero additional loss to the circuit.
Well, I believe you're right, but you're not hitting the subject. Inductors with low inductive reactance are much less critical of the internal and external strain capacitance. Optimum form factor in a low reactance inductor leans towards a short coil with a diameter nearly equaling the length. So in tank circuits, or with the loading coils in the antenna used with the longer antennas, or with the capacitance heat, the optimum inductor shape becomes shorter or larger in the diameter. And in short mobile antenna, a very high impedance tank system or circuit, optimum inductor form factor becomes longer when compared to the diameter. Long high inductance coils are generally good. A large diameter inductors often work better in low inductance ranges. By that, I don't see much difference with comparing to what you said. It is just the most optimal form of core inductors used for the antenna between 1-to-1 and 4-to-1 length diameters ratios. The exact, depending on inductor and terminating reactances, a coil behaves the same way regardless if used as a long coil or as used as a tank inductor. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Wesley, but again, I think you're veering off the subject. The simple concept was that any additional circuitry is going to introduce a degree of loss. It might not be a severe one, or it could be a severe one, and different ways of electronically resonating a radiator will introduce different losses. And so, you know, how to design a coil is all well and good, but none of them will be absolutely the theoretical lossless devices. They all introduce a degree of loss. And getting back to Les's actually original question was, you know, what would he lose by putting a small helical twist into a dipole so that it takes up less mechanical distance and so that he can put it on a rotator more easily and get the option of rotating his helically coiled dipole in space. So, you know, I think we're getting a little bit too esoteric here.
I, well, I think we should ask somebody else for the opinion, because so far we both are trying to agree and disagree. Maybe somebody else has a better idea. I can go to the example of 5/8 antennas with the loading coil and try to explain what is the myth and what is the reality of it. But let's listen to somebody else's opinion. Enter XGS.
Well, I agree with that concept. Again, I think we can broaden this discussion to take approximately 500 hours and cover a lot of material and fatigue everyone. I think we should kind of focus in on Les's question. I think it was a fascinating question, and we should kind of get some sense of whether our gut senses are reasonable or not. If anyone out there has any other experiences or would like to discuss the concept of a slightly helically coiled dipole, please give me your call sign and your name.
WA2VDH with a quick comment.
Yes, John, please.
Well, I'm going to quote Dick on this one. That even if you modify the antenna with helical coils or anything, if you can bring it into resonance with either an antenna tuner or some other means, if you bring it into resonance, you're going to get pretty much about 99% of the full performance of the antenna. So you may have to put an antenna tuner on it after doing some coiling of the wires or something, but if you can bring it into resonance, it's going to get pretty much full performance. Now, you may have to have some fairly high-quality components in your tuner. You don't want to wind any inductances with nichrome wire or something like that. You want to use some high-quality components. But if you can bring it into resonance with the tuner, you should get full performance. Go ahead.
Goes back to my my comment about JPL Labs. You know, if you have, you know, almost none of us have really highly efficient impedance matching. It suffices, and you know, you don't need the 99.99% of the power that you put out to get to the antenna. We all kind of compromise insertion losses every single day. And as far as the antenna tuner, probably Les could just tweak the length of the helically coiled antenna so that it is once again resonant even without an external impedance matching network.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And but if you didn't have that ability, you could use a tuner. But yeah, to me, as long as it brings it into resonance, tweaking it or otherwise, it should get the pretty good performance out of it.
And I would agree as well. I don't like to play devil's advocate, but I tend to do it. It's just it wouldn't be 100% efficient, but I think the difference between the two states would be inconsequential. Okay, anyone else with any opinions? I think we've pretty much said what we all were saying. It sounds like a very good experiment. I would love it if Les comes back later on and tells us how it worked out, whether he was able to tune the antenna so that it's resonant without the need of an external antenna tuner, and how it worked for him, and what kind of gain he feels he got from the rotation of it. So I think that would be interesting. But nevertheless, if anyone else has any particular opinion on this subject, give me your call sign and your first name.
There is nobody else. I would like to agree with the opinion just expressed. The inductor has a certain amount of serious reactances, that's all, nothing else. When you are in a resonance, I don't see how much you lose or what is that you lose. You're not dealing with anything that creates losses. unless I'm wrong. Dr. Roy, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. So, Les, I hope what we chewed around the surrounding concepts gave you something more to deal with. But I think you have a good idea, and I'm looking forward to find out how it works for you. Okay, I guess we'll move on to the next questioner, John, N2ZC. You had a question or a topic tonight?
Yeah, thank you very much. Just recently I put in some wiring in my house, and, you know, just basic AC, 117 and a couple of 220 outlets, and, you know, had some friends that are electricians guiding me. And along the way, things they told me I found very interesting. I was, you know, a little like, what? That works? Okay, of course I wouldn't challenge them. But now I'm trying to get back and, you know, like all of us, when something comes in front. And you don't understand it, you try to, and I'm not quite getting this. And I think it'd be pretty simple for you. In your power coming into the house, some have two-phase, some have three-phase. I've always visualized this as we were taught with a coil. AC is generated with a coil with a magnet going up and down in the middle, and positive on the top, negative on the bottom as the magnet pulls up and down. And I always envisioned that the wires coming into your house, one was connected to the top of the coil, one was connected to the bottom. Let me just put the repeater up. And, of course, I'm familiar with the transformer where you can tap into it, a center coil, and that would be the zero mark. So my question tonight is, if somebody could just give me an explanation I could grab onto. Envisioning this coil creating an AC with a magnet going up and down, for a three-phase coming into a building, three-phase, so that would mean you would have three hot lakes and a ground. Where would these taps be? Because where my problem comes in is I can understand with neutral, if center tapped in the coil always being zero, to the opposite ends of the coil, but when you're introducing three phase, how do you get a zero neutral for all three?
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
All right. Usually, the three phase generator has a DC rotor. Theoretically, be permanent magnets, but if you want to regulate the voltage, you have to have it as an initial magnet and a feedback loop to control the current to the rotor to maintain the output. Three windings at 120 degrees separation, and you generate three phases. Now, there's two ways to do it. There's the so-called delta configuration, where there is no ground, they're all floating. And there's the Y, kind of like a letter Y, where you have a three-way center tap that goes to earth ground. Typically, the generator is a Y configuration with an earth ground, and a three-phase load, like a motor, has a delta, and it's floating. Let me let it drop. Any comments, or not? And let me know if I should continue about what happens with the house.
Please, go on, Ed.
No, but a three-phase generator has to rotate at exactly some 3,600 RPM or some sub-multiple, typically 1,800 RPM, to get 60 cycle power. There's a direct one-to-one correspondence between the RPM and the frequency, so you must have a very careful speed control. And you must regulate the voltage by varying the electromagnet on the rotor. And then, you, of course, you use three-phase transformers to step it up and down. But usually when you're creating a new voltage, you have a Y configuration with an earth ground, and then the load is the floating delta. When it gets to your house, if it's three-phase, there's two ways of doing it. There's, let me call it the Con Ed way and the Lilco way. The Lilco way is you take one phase and generate a transformer. That's 120-0-120. In other words, if you set one terminal as 120 degrees at 0 degrees, there's a ground in the middle. The center tap is grounded or neutral. And the other one's 120 at 180 degrees, the inverse. That's what most of us have in our houses on Long Island. The city, they take two phases, step them down to 120, but there, with the Lilco system, it's 230 volts line to line. With the Con Ed system, it's 208 volts line to line. All right, have I been of any help at all?
John, does that answer your question?
You know, it quite obviously, he understands it well. Maybe I'm lacking a knowledge of motors and, you know, maybe it's just a whole other area I'd have to study. I was, again, just trying to visualize it as a magnet going through a coil and creating AC. You know, typical primary electronics we all learn. And the top positive, the bottom negative, you could tap in the middle, and now you'd have the two-phase. And if you took that scenario, is it possible, looking at that coil with a magnet going through it, is it possible to get a three-phase out of that, or no?
No. You need three spatially distant windings on the stator of the generator. What you have is a rotating magnetic field, and three of the windings you've described that are more or less independent, faced at a third of a circle from each other. Although I will tell you, this day and age, with using electronic inverters, you can probably do just about anything you want, but you want to pay for it.
Comment on one Whitey White?
Yes, Hank.
Yeah, I think what your original questioner, and I'm sorry I missed his call sign, was confusing, is you're not really taking a center tap and having two phases that are 180 degrees out to get three phase. That's not how they do it. They actually have what Ed's describing, where it's, you know, Y it's phase to ground, or in a delta it's phase to phase, and it's either 115, 208, or city, or it's 20 or 115 dirty here in Long. But it takes three phases, all three phases, not two phases with a center ground.
And let me add, when you're talking about serious power, then you use three-phase motors and the like.
Yeah, but that's phase-to-phase, what we were talking about before.
Agreed.
Okay, so let me put it a different way. Two-phase. Would it be an accurate description of it? And again, going back to the coil with the magnet going through it, a two-phase of a coil being tapped at the top for one phase, at the bottom for one phase, and in the center for the neutral. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Should I take it?
Yeah, Ed, please.
You're making it sound like you have one turn of wire. You probably have thousands of turns of wire for any serious generator. Let's say you have 1,000 turns of wire. You have 500 turns, tap it, then another 500 turns. So one wire end is, let's say, 120. The other wire end is also 120, but 180 degrees out of phase, and that little center tap is the ground. But physically, they're all in this one big bundle that the magnet keeps going past.
Okay, no, I could visualize that. I just wasn't looking to get into the generator itself, just on the pure, most simplistic form of understanding the phase differences. So again, can I just ask this? A simple generator that just has, as we all learned in the first course in electronics, a coil, one coil with a magnet going up and down, inducing, cutting through the lines of electromagnetic force as it goes up and down, induces a voltage, an AC voltage. And if you tap the top of the coil and the bottom of the coil and the center, would that give you two phases? You know, if it's going at 60 hertz, would that give you 120 if you went from the zero to the top and 120 from the zero to the bottom? And if you went from the top to the bottom, 240. Could that be a legitimate two-phase circuit?
No.
I don't know who said no, but absolutely that would be two-phase separated by 180 degrees. Usually they don't use the term phases there. But yeah, there's no reason why you can't have a tapped winding on a generator and get 120 is zero, ground in the middle, and 120 in the middle of the coil, which is just one tap, and then 120 zero. And the fellow who said no, you want to clarify?
No. So phase means it's mechanically separated. It's separated by degrees. Over.
Yeah, 180 is inverted.
The machine would have to be developing 180. Over.
It should be done. It should be done.
It could be done, but that's not what's being supplied to your house. Over.
Correct. What your house is coming is derived from three phase, where you do that in a transformer.
What's coming into your house is one phase, 220, with a center tap over.
That's exactly what I'm describing. Absolutely true. Agreed.
One other comment, and one whitey-white.
Yes, Hank.
I once had a boat that had a generator that was a little more complex. It was asynchronous and it was electronically controlled. But it, in fact, produced both 110 and 220 as what this other gentleman was describing as a two-pole coil with a center tap.
And again,
I'm a little confused. That sounded like W2BZ, but I don't know where he fits into this conversation. Rich, is that you? You're about 75% noise right now, unfortunately. Okay, understood, Rich. Hank, you want to finish your comment?
Well, I was just saying that it's theoretically possible to build a generator like the gentleman just described. It's not what comes into your house. And I had a generator like this in a boat that I once owned. And again, I said it was a little more complex than a simple wire coil because it had an asynchronous phase control system or frequency control system, but it was in fact essentially a two-phase with a center tap, and it was delivered 115 and 230, depending upon what you were driving with the generator. So it is doable that way, is all I'm trying to say, but it's not common to find it in home electrical installations.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
How do you copy me on this machine, first of all?
About 20-30% noise.
Okay, is it fair to say that you have a three-phase generator, each phase is 120 degrees apart, and if you take one of those 120-degree phases and split it, so you have 180 and 180. Isn't that what they're doing?
Yeah, that's the loco way.
Okay, and my final question is, the guy who yelled no, did he ever identify himself?
This is K2GJE. I'll answer any three-phase question, over.
All right, I'm out. Back to net.
Actually, I think the discussion never really went to three-phase other than me.
Okay, I lost track who was talking about what. I have put up a link, again, if you want to go to roy.ac2gs.com. There's a link to, you know, some people like Wikipedia, some people don't. You can take a look at what a high-leg delta transformer looks like. You know, illustrations are very helpful usually, but eventually I'll figure out a way of getting illustrations onto a radio. But until then, I have the link source. So, John, if you're interested, you could take a look at that article. There's loads of stuff on the Internet. But back to the conversation.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think what may be confusing the issue a little bit is, what I'll call the Mr. Wizard model of the generator, of taking the magnet and shoving it into the coil. Relative to the sensor tap, each side of that coil will be 180 out of phase. So with the sensor tap, relative to the top of the coil would be one phase, and from the sensor tap relative to the bottom of the coil would be the opposite phase. When the magnet moves down, the top will be positive, the bottom will be negative relative to the sensor tap, and vice versa when the magnet moves up. But I think it's a little better to think of it in terms of a rotating machine. You get a better understanding where you can extend it to three, understanding three phase, if you work with a rotating machine rather than what I call the Mr. Wizard model of the magnet shoved into the coil. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the problem is that model is very good for explanations and very simple devices. Utility companies don't use devices that simple, and so in the real world, the way that they get three phases is not as simple as the Mr. Rogers method, Mr. Science, whatever.
I do have a comment, Roy.
Certainly, yes.
Here's a cute little fun fact. I once worked on a generating system that actually used linear motion. There was a magnet with a coil wound around it. It was like a horseshoe magnet with a coil wound around it. And the magnetic path had to be completed by putting a bar of steel across the horseshoe. And that bar of steel was the wheel flange on a passing railroad train wheel. And what this would do, it was to generate a single plus then minus pulse every time a railroad wheel went past it.
That's a cute device.
Problem is, the area under the curve is constant. So at high speeds, you have a tremendous, very short period of time. At slow speed, it's all drawn out, and you don't have enough voltage. And that's when the need came out for the so-called zero-speed wheel transducer, and that's where I came in. But that's another story for another day.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Ed. I just wanted to add in from the chat room, Chris was asking whether using a device designed for 240 on a 220-volt circuit, it can be problematic. And as far as I'm aware, most consumer devices tend to have that little bit of wiggle room calculated in. The only time I've really heard people complain is old-time amateur operators where their tubes didn't quite give them the gain that were in the specs because they were getting less than 220 volts. So they would gin up some kind of auto transformer to bring their voltages up to the specs. But otherwise, and again, if anyone has any opinions, I don't think too many people have had too many problems with having somewhat underrated voltages with the appliances that are made these days.
Comment, WB2EAD again.
Yes, Ed.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far away, I lived in Bayside, Queens. And I forget what it was, but we bought some new, you know, high-voltage appliance. And I made sure that the salesman, being in the city with Con Ed, I made sure that the device was rated for 208 volts. And the salesman said, yeah, the stores in the city tend to have 208 volt models. The ones on Long Island tend to have 230 volt models. So be careful if you're buying your city house and appliance out in Nassau County.
Okay, that's interesting. I can't kind of remember because I've looked at lots of specs for air conditioners. And I don't really remember that as a differentiator, but that's interesting.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
I have a question. Maybe Ed can answer it. So are one of those two systems predominant nationally? I mean, are we just looking at a rare exception in one of these municipalities, or is it 50-50? What do you think?
Oh, I have an answer. I'm going to drop it. If you ever go for a drive and you pass high voltage power lines, you will find they're always in multiples of three. You absolutely, positively, beyond a shadow of a doubt, when you're talking about serious power, it's three phase, period, end of discussion. The question we're discussing now is what happens at the transformer on top of the pole. Do you have one center tapped winding, we'll go, or two phases, two windings with common ground, Con Ed? But anything in real high power, absolutely three phase all the way throughout the world.
Well, my question is, all right, the transmission is similar. However, as you say, as they tap it off, either they go from phase to phase or they split the coil in the middle, as Wilco does. Are either of those methods more popular than the other?
Unfortunately, the reason I say Con Ed is Wilco, because those are the only ones who I have hands-on experience with, I really don't know which is more prevalent at the point of use.
Roger, roger.
Okay, very good. Thank you, everyone. John, I hope that adds something to your understanding of this subject.
It definitely gave me, you know, more to think about and in what direction to go, and also, which is always important, just to confirm that my original thought on the coil, the very primitive model, was accurate. So then I could build upon that, because we all know the foundation is the most important. So I'm going to look up these circular generators and everything, and maybe I'll even jump in next week with a different question on the same subject. So thank you very much to everybody who contributed.
Okay, thank you, John, for participating and for giving us this interesting question. And thanks to Ed, both Eds, and Lou, and all the other people who answered. It's getting to be 9 o'clock, which is a little bit late, but I hope that Andy forgives me. But it's time for Andy's Corner. WA2CDL is going to share with us some articles and written material that he's gleaned on the subject of transmission lines. So I'm looking forward to it. So, Andy, please, take it away.
Okay, Roy, thank you very much. Yeah, I've been waiting with bated breath. But, folks, listening into this, all this jazz, as Dick used to say, stick around because you ain't heard, you ain't seen nothing yet. No, actually, welcome to Andy's Corner, and I'm going to try to convey some information. And believe me, I'm no expert. I'm not professing to know any of this stuff. I'm just reading material and trying to make some sense out of it, which I think we all do anyway. So this